History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time to ask a few questions from some of our more experienced neighbors. More importantly, take a little time to listen intently and patiently. We're going to learn a lot. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, yeah, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. And so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that'll be the case today in Shaver Lake, California, where we have the privilege of visiting with 95-year-old Eugene Jacobson, or Jake, as everybody knows him around these parts. Shaver Lake is a beautiful place. Just driving up today, I'm seeing wildflowers on the hills everywhere, then the devastation that the Creek Fire left behind. Before I get into your childhood and your service in World War II, what do you appreciate about living in this little corner of the world here in Shaver Lake?
It was a real pleasure to move up here. You know, my wife and I retired from Vineyard in Salma, California, and we needed to move from there, and we were trying to decide where to go, and because my oldest son had MS, we needed to go up higher in the mountains than just the foothills because heat is hard on MS patients. And so we moved up here and found a home here and got interested in the church and been here and had a great time ever since, fishing and what have you, and did deer hunting before I moved up here, but since moved up here, I didn't.
I saw three deer on your porch when I walked in.
Oh, you did.
Well, I guess those are made out of wood. You probably put those together yourself.
Yeah.
Do you know any other 95-year-olds who still plow their own driveway?
No.
How often do you have to do that up here?
When it snows enough to make it worthwhile. Or you have to plow it to get out.
So you've had to do that once or twice this winter already?
Oh, yes. When that storm came through here a month or two ago, we were plowing it twice a day.
Ooh. Well, I'll have to get your secret a little bit later on, but let's go back in time a little bit. You're 95 now, but let's hear about the early years when you were growing up between Selma and Kingsburg in Central California in the 20s and 30s. What do you remember about your childhood?
Well, I was a puny little kid with asthma and couldn't do the normal things, and plus I'm a full-blooded Danish heritage, and I matured real slowly in high school. And, well, even when I went in the service, I probably weighed about 105 and was 5'7". And I delayed going in because I figured they weren't going to take me.
Because you weren't big enough?
Because I wasn't big enough and mature enough. And so my dad had a vineyard, and so I got deferred to help in the vineyard. And the draft board came out when the next year started and says, you know, you can be deferred. You don't have to go. And I says, no. I says, I want to go. And that time, everyone wanted to go. There's no question about it. And I'd have been real disappointed that I didn't go. But anyway, I did go. And they took me, and everyone was surprised that I'd gone. And so I got the basic training, and I had made up my mind beforehand that I was going to do everything they could do if possible. And so in the obstacle course, why, the sergeant finally stopped me. I tried a couple times to go over it and get in. And he says, you can just go around it, you know. And I said, no, I said, I'm going to go over it. So I did, and went to basic training and got a pass to go to town. And everyone was stopping me in town and says, what in the thunder are you doing in the service? You don't look a day over 16. Well, so that was the last time I went to town. I stayed at the PX and did that. You know, by the time I got into combat and ended up with the ribbons and combat badge and everything, I could prove to the world that I could make it.
I'm curious, even before that, because a lot of young people will listen to this, and young people who are 10, 12, 15, 18, and their world has changed in the last year, and you lived through some times where the world changed significantly. And even in your childhood, I mean, your early years, it's the Great Depression and the years coming out of the Depression. Were you aware of any of that? Are there some things you look back on and say, oh, that was that way because that's what was happening at the time?
No, I think we, you know what was going on. Your parents were having hard times, you know, as far as being able to make money and danger of losing the ranch and what have you. And so you knew there was that. And you learned to frugal in, you know, and how you spent money. You didn't just spend it foolishly. You learned that. And I still have trouble today, still, you know, just unless something's really worth it, don't spend it.
That discipline sticks with you. And growing up around a raisin vineyard, how early did you have to get involved in the work of that vineyard?
Well, because I had asthma so badly, I couldn't go out in the field and dust and animals and everything. But by the time I graduated from high school, I was outgrowing asthma. I didn't have it anymore and went into the service, and they asked if he had asthma, and I said no, because I didn't want to be turned down. So I didn't tell them the truth, but I never had it since then.
How about that? And do you remember as a kid having an idea in your head, a dream, an ambition? Something like, you know, when I grow up, here's what I want to do with my life?
No, I really didn't. I just enjoying life and taking it. I didn't have any thing what I was going to do. And growing up in the vineyard, I decided that I'll never be a farmer. I went to the service and got limited duty and had some hindrance after being wounded. And so I went on the job training and got a job in Fresno at a plastic manufacturing company and enjoyed it and everything, and ended up cutting at the end of my two fingers off. And so being that happened on the job training, they considered the same as a war disability along with what I'd gotten a tendon cut in my other hand. And so they increased my payment too for being wounded. But I went there and I ended up cutting my two fingers. I said, well, maybe farming isn't so bad after all, you know. And so I ended up getting a farm and making raisins like my dad had done. So,
well, and you know, for folks who don't live around Central California, they've probably heard the line in the Broadway musical about you get your raisins from Fresno. But if they drive through Selma, they know it's Selma who claims raisin capital of the world. Yeah. Is that a source of pride for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I enjoy it. And they used to have the dancing raisins room and the cars would come out. So it was good.
Do you have a favorite variety of raisin that you grew?
Yeah, was Sunmade. I always belonged to Sunmade all the time. My dad did, and one of the reasons, because you don't have to try to figure out the price you're going to get, because Sunmade is a co-op, and you put it in there. Mm-hmm. First year it's hard, because they just pay you a down payment, but after you're in for 1 year, it doesn't matter, because you're getting last year's payment in the next year.
Gotcha. And as far as the varieties of grapes, did you have some that you liked more than others, or did you only grow one?
I had both Muscats and Thompsons. Mm-hmm. And Thompson's what they make raisins out of. And so I have made raisins out of both of them. Muscats are bigger, taste different, and have seeds.
And a lot of people, I mean, I've been around the country a fair amount. There are people in other parts of the country who don't know there's more than one kind of raisin, right? But you can make a raisin out of any kind of grape.
Yep.
I like the Muscat raisins, and I like the flame grape raisins, too. That's a favorite of mine.
And the Thompson seeds, so they can make golden bleach.
Mm-hmm.
Different taste.
So having grown millions of raisins, do you still like to eat raisins?
Sure.
Is that part of
grapes?
They're not bad when you pick them fresh either.
I know. And you wait until, you know, you've already picked them for raisins and you just leave them on the vine, or a few of them that they leave.
Mm-hmm.
Get sweeter and sweeter and they get better and better.
Like candy on the vine, huh?
They are.
Well, while we're on the topic of the raisins, is there anything that, because you spent so much of your life in that business of growing raisins, is there anything that you think would be a misconception people have about raisins, or something you've heard that you say, no, that's not quite the way it is?
The best raisins are the kind that you just get through drying in the sun and put them in the box and eat them. You don't send them to the co-op and they put water on them, and it ruins the taste as far as I'm concerned. The best raisins are just right out of the field, dirt and all.
Dirt and all.
Dirt and all.
That's part of your secret, huh?
Yeah.
Well, so you're going to high school, Selma High School, and December 7th, 1941 rolls around. Do you remember that day and how you found out what happened?
Yeah. Our Baptist church was having in Barrels Park in Visalia. They have a park there. The church was having a Sunday school picnic down there that day after church. And on the way down there, we turned on the radio, and it was talking about Pearl Harbor. And so it was a real shock to us to know it was in, but I was on the way to the party.
And once you got there, I imagine that that word was spreading around.
Yeah, it was all over, yeah.
Did you have any inkling at the time that this might be something you would have to personally get involved with?
No. You know, it was 41, and I still had 2 years of high school. I didn't know what was going on. You know, you're just wondering. But as it developed, the kids were, you know, in high school, the seniors were enlisting. And so I always wanted to, you know, and I didn't think would I get big enough to make it.
Yeah, so you said, you know, you have asthma, you're undersized, you're thinking the Army's not going to take me. Initially, they give you a deferment because all those soldiers overseas were getting raisins in their care packages, and somebody needed to grow the raisins for them to eat. And you could have stayed on the farm. You had another deferment. Yet you turned that down. You lied about your asthma. You're trying to put on weight so you're big enough to serve. Why was that so important? What was your motivation to get over there and be in the armed forces?
I don't really know, except that everyone was going, and your desire was to go to, you want to be a part of it. So it was more or less a wish or desire that you wanted to accomplish, and you wanted to prove to your classmates or to the world that you might be small, but your spirit was willing and wanted it.
And I'm not trying to make something there that isn't there, but it kind of sounds like maybe you felt you had something to prove. Were there guys that ribbed you or teased you about being small?
Well, you couldn't play sports. I mean, because you weren't big enough, football or basketball or, you know, anything. That was always a desire to be part of the group.
Yeah.
And when you couldn't do it, you wanted it all the more, I think. And luckily, I got into an old outfit in the Army. I mean, the 3rd Division had been clear at North Africa and Sicily and Italy and invasion of southern France. It didn't go in on D-Day. They were fighting in Italy in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you went in, and it's an old outfit. And if you're going into combat, you want to go with an old outfit and not some fresh one out of the States.
Well, and you mentioned that. I mean, the 3rd Infantry Division has the record, I believe, for the most days in combat in World War II. 531 days. And you weren't in for all that. You weren't old enough yet. You weren't there yet. But tell me about when you first got into the Army and you go to basic training. You mentioned the obstacle course. Were there some other kind of welcome to the Army moments that you experienced?
Yeah, there's the thing that's different about, you know, you see the movies today, like that movie Fury. The guy comes as a replacement and they just downgrade him and, you know, grade him do things. And the 3rd Division, you go into it and most of the guys are, you have to be 19 before you could go overseas. And so all of us were just 19 and were shipped over. When you go into the outfit, they look after you. They don't downgrade you or anything. I went in and I looked young, and a platoon sergeant, we were back behind the line, just across the river, they were going to take the next place. And I went in, and the platoon sergeant had a Tommy gun, and he handed me a gun, and he says, here's your new weapon, your first scout, first squad, first platoon. And so he gave it to me. And the second day out, he says, Jake, he says, I'm going to try to keep you alive. He says, you do whatever I do, lock in on me. And if I run, you run. If I hit the ground, you hit the ground. And he had 36 other guys to take care of beside me. And yet somehow the Lord says, look after that guy. And so that I got to know him, and after I got hit, he was in the hospital too, and got to talk to him. After the war, I got his address and everything, wrote him and thanked him for taking care of me. But that's the kind of guys that I was used to, not like in the movies they have now, you know, where they're downgrading your force and they try to help you, they try to keep you alive.
And what was his name?
Pete Petronek.
And when you were getting ready to go overseas, was there any anxious thought that you had about what you were getting into or whether or not you'd ever come back to the States and see your family again?
No, that didn't enter my mind at that time. It wasn't until after you got in combat that you get three choices. You either get killed, or you get wounded, or you get captured. And you pray that you're going to get wounded. Very, very few outlive it.
And even I'm interested in every little element of this because I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You know, so you were 19 years old when right. you're heading overseas. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No.
And your hometown of Selma at that time, what do you think the population was?
It was probably several thousand, you know.
You probably had as many people on the ship or more than you had in your hometown, huh?
Yeah.
What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you?
They put us on an old English ship. That would be a luxury liner type of thing. And so we didn't go in a convoy. Took us 5 days to go across the Atlantic. We hit the rough seas, and all of us began to get seasick. I don't usually get seasick, but they said if you start getting seasick, get up, put a hammock, and lay in it because it takes one motion out of it. You still go up and down, but you don't swing. And so I was starting getting sick, so I got a hammock and put it up and went in it and went to sleep and woke up and everyone was sick and as ever headed for the latrine to throw up, but I didn't get sick.
I'll have to remember that if I ever end up in those circumstances.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said something about the choices that you were going to have in an infantry outfit in Europe, and you said you pray that you would get wounded. Now, is that a figure of speech, or did you actually pray that specific prayer?
No, you prayed that. Lord, just help me. You know, if I'm going to get hit, why, I mean, you pray that you get hit. And, you go in with a full company, usually. I mean, when we move down to where we're fighting in Benware, we're full company there. And by that evening, over half of my company was killed, captured, or wounded.
Mm.
But in the midst of that, you're a bunch of 19-year-old kids, except our platoon leader he was an old man. He's probably 21 or 22.
An old man, yep.
But because your spirit is still there, you can enjoy it in spite of what goes on. You put so much adrenaline into your body, you shake all the time. But you can still live with it.
And he's living proof. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 95-year-old Jake Jacobson of Shaver Lake, California. For photos and a short video of Mr. Jacobson, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 95-year-old Jake Jacobson of Shaver Lake, California. He grew up in a raisin vineyard in Selma, California, but it was a vineyard in France where his life almost came to an end on December 30th, 1944. If that had been the case, he never would have experienced 66 years of marriage to his sweetheart, Joe. He never would have enjoyed the accomplishments of his four children, not to mention 7 grandchildren and now 10 great-grandchildren. You heard him explain how determined he was to serve in the Army in World War II, declining a deferment and hiding his history of asthma. Jake would eventually become part of the legendary 3rd Infantry Division.
I was in the infantry, but we were special jobs in the infantry. We were radio operators, code messengers, and all different kinds, truck drivers, reconnaissance and everything. And so they didn't need us as infantry at that time, so they shipped us to England, and we stayed in England for 2 months training, and then it's just about when the Battle of the Bulge was beginning, and so all of a sudden they needed all kinds of infantry, regular straight infantry, so we all got our spec number changed and went into the infantry. And so we trained for a couple of months there and got to know each other real good, and went, and most of us went to the 3rd Division. They were always trying to fill out that up with at that time. And that's one thing that the Army needs to do, is keep better contact. Tell the soldiers what's going on. We knew the Battle of Bulge was going on, but we didn't know that all the replacements was going over there because they were in dire circumstance. And so we weren't getting any, and we were going down from a full company of 200-plus men down to, by the time I got hit, we were down, could only get 14 men out of I Company to attack that night. So they had to get 10 from K and 10 from L and 10 from anti-tankers and everything. And we were going to go on the attack because even if they were going to shoot us, we didn't care anymore because we thought we were going to lose our lives there. So we said, you know, we're not going to go attack even if they shoot us. But we ended up, they pulled 3 tanks in on us and got 10 guys from all the rest of the companies and went on attack that night. And so they need to say what's going on. You know, we can't give you any men because there isn't any to get, you know.
I know there's a lot of veterans identifying with you there. Just to follow up on what you shared, the 2 months you spent training in England. So at that point, you didn't think you were going to be in a regular rifle platoon or reconnaissance platoon. Or
we thought it was going to be more in a special place, which is dangerous, but not like combat infantry.
What did you think you were going to be doing?
They put me in the radio, but I can't memorize things. And so they said, you know, so they pulled me out of there and put me in the message center, which is running a decoding machine that codes messages and interprets them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I thought I'd probably end up, you know.
And while you were in England there, did you get a sense for what the British people had been through in this war and see some of the devastation there?
Yes, we saw that. And there wasn't any rockets coming in at that time. They were gone more to the bombing and stuff.
The buzz bomb threat had kind of dissipated.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It wasn't as bad. And another thing that made it bad in this Benwear was this is a little part of France that hadn't been taken yet, and they were determined that they were going to keep it for spring when they could invade, still thinking they could invade. And so they filled it with SS troops, which are entirely different troop than a regular army. We were on the move. It was after they'd got into southern France and got the breakthrough going through there. And so in one day, we walked 30 miles. The Germans were pulling out right ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And the French were lining the streets with all their liquor. I mean, feeding to the Americans for taking it. And so we marched 30 miles. The company commander got drunk, and he was decided we were going to go on and push up and take the next town. And he'd found out that there was a German SP gun, which is an anti-tank gun up ahead. But we'd walked 30 miles, so he said, well, are you going to put you on tanks and take you on up there? So we loaded on 5 tanks and started up in the next village, and I was on the 3rd tank. They drove up there, and they got into the range of that anti-tank gun, and it knocked out the front tank. The 2nd tank jabbed it in reverse and started backing up, and he started backing over my tank. So we jumped off, and our platoon sergeant, the one that was taking care of me, he says, take off and go back to the next town we're through and go into the houses. So we went back there and got into the houses, and he says, company commander's drunk, we're not going to follow him. He says, go in there and stay quiet. Just go in there and don't do anything. And even if they call I Company to come out, don't come out. And so he said it. I did it. And so the rest of the guys did too. So we went into the houses, burst into the I Company, all fall out. And so we didn't fall out. So we didn't fall out till the next morning. We came out, where's I Company? It's cut off the road someplace in the next town or more. So we walked up there and never heard a word about where were we? What were we doing? Anything else? But one of the things you do on your own when you figure that it's suicide.
Yeah, I was going to say, that probably saved your life.
Yeah.
And so this is December 1944.
Yes.
In France. What was the weather like?
It was just before the night I got hit, it snowed. It was real cold up there. It's Bald Siege Mountains, and so the ground was frozen solid, and you couldn't even dig foxholes. Your hands would cramp up from trying to bed through it. You'd have to find out where a shell had landed. But the night I got hit, it snowed. It snowed from there.
And I need to hear the story about the night you got hit, but I'm sure there are a few things leading up to it, because you got hit less than a week after Christmas, and I believe you guys were in Ben Weir, a place you would later get to go back decades later and see the village that you guys had liberated. What was happening in Ben Weir on Christmas Eve of 1944?
Christmas Eve. Well, first of all, we were running patrols. We couldn't be outside in daytime. If there's one or two soldiers out there, Germans would put 88 in there on us, try to knock us out. And so all of our, because we didn't have any men, we'd go out every night, almost on a night patrol. And earlier Christmas Day, they'd tell them, you guys are going to get your Christmas dinner tonight. Promise us, but we didn't get it. And then this is a week later, almost. They says, you guys are lucky, you're going to get your Christmas dinner, turkey, and all the trimmings, you know. Right after they told us that we were getting it, they said, you're going on another patrol tonight. And we just, the night before, almost gotten a bunch of guys killed and captured, and we thought, oh no, you know, so we lost our appetite for for Christmas dinner.
Well, if you're going to say that, I have to ask you what happened. If you said you almost got a bunch of guys killed and captured, that sounds like a pretty memorable patrol. What can you tell me about that?
Well, like I say, you know, a bunch of guys, all of us 19, we liberated a German PX and all got army, alles für Deutschland, on the blade, and when I went back to rest camp, I got to send them to all the guys first in our squad that got one. And so, it was a time of fear and trembling, but yet you could still survive in it. You learn to live in it.
You know, for instance, that patrol that you're talking about, what was the objective of your patrol? You're trying to find out where some Germans are?
Well, the patrol was mostly to capture prisoners, to find out what the Germans were up to and what they, you get in firefights. And firefights is at night, so you couldn't see individuals to shoot at. You just lay down a base of fire so they couldn't raise their head up. You don't know who or what you hit, but you learn to do it, yeah.
Well, and I imagine you also don't know where they're going to be firing at you from.
No.
That sounds a little scary, a little nerve-wracking, a little alarming.
You know, if the bullet's got your number on it, it'll get you. I mean, you get that fatal attitude that you either get hit or not get hit. So it's different, you know.
So you were resigned to it and not afraid?
You're afraid. You're scared. You reach a point that you don't figure you'll come out of it alive.
And you'd probably seen some guys who weren't coming out of it alive.
Yeah, well, it's one, the day I came into Ben Weir, because our company had been annihilated, they put K Company to take the town instead of us. So they put us on outpost duty. We had up above, and was moved into one of their streets and one of their places there, and sitting, and we could hear the fighting, and pretty soon sounded like a German tank coming down the road towards us. So we watched and see, you know, if that was a German tank, and sure enough, here around the corner came this German tank, and we thought, oh man, we're in trouble, you know, because one shot could kill a bunch of us. And then behind it was one GI with an M1 rifle chasing this tank. It had jammed, someone had jammed the turret of the tank on the road up ahead farther from us, and he was chasing the tank down the road towards us. It went right by us. Every time a German would pop up its head out of the turret, he'd take a shot at it. And so the guy ducked down, and they just kept chasing the tank on the road past us, and our anti-tank gun down the road a little bit, and it knocked it out.
That's something you don't get to see every day.
No.
So you went
thankful.
Yeah. And it sounds like emotionally you went from being very fearful to almost entertained by that.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned, you've said a couple times, you know, the losses that your company absorbed. And I know these things aren't easy to talk about, but this is one of the reasons we do this program, to help us understand, those who haven't been in combat, who didn't live through this, the price that's paid for our freedom. And I'm sure some of those guys who were killed and wounded were guys that you'd gotten to know a little bit.
Yeah.
How hard was that for you as a 19-year-old to process what you were seeing and experiencing as guys just like you were giving their lives?
One of my friends, Goodred England, he got sent to the 3rd Division the same as I did. And on his way in the Jeep, all up to the front, his Jeep hit a mine and he was killed. And he never did, you know, make it. You know, you learn to accept it. Like another time, this other friend of mine, we were told, him and I, to take, go up to the, contact the company in the next town. And so we started up this road from Benware on up to Singweshide. All of a sudden, a sniper started shooting at us. And a bullet that's being shot at you cracks as it goes by you. You can tell it's a, he's trying to knock you out. He was just walking along. I says, "Dale," I says, "let's get out of here. We're, you know," and he didn't, his hearing wasn't very good, so he didn't know the difference. So we ran out of there, and he didn't hit either one of us. But you could tell that we were zeroed in, and just some of the things that you experience.
And were there some other close calls that you had before the day you were hit?
Yeah, you couldn't tell, but like I say, most of the Germans, a lot of it, were pulling out. We got in, you know, some fights or what have you, but they were pulling out ahead of us and made it easier going for a while.
For a while. And none of this sounds easy to most of us. I hope you realize that. I'm sure growing up, Christmas was probably a pretty big deal for you.
Right.
How memorable was Christmas 1944? How often do you think about it with all the Christmases that have come since?
I do, especially around Christmas time, I think of it.
What was it like to be a 19-year-old out freezing your tail off half a world away from your family and realizing, hey, it's Christmas?
Yeah, it was different, let's put it that way. But you just accepted it. You know, you programming it in. Okay, I'm here. And I'm either going to make it out or I'm not going to make it out. But let me say one thing. You know, I had enough of the Bible to know that you don't make promises to the Lord that you're not intended or won't keep. And so I knew enough in the middle of Benware, sitting in a foxhole, to not promise God I'll serve him unquittably for the rest of my life. But I did reach the place I said, "Lord, if you get me out of here alive, I'll never complain about anything again." Tried to keep that.
That's for more than 76 years you've been keeping that. I can see how much that means to you, and I think everyone can hear the sincerity in your voice, and if they could see your eyes right now, they'd really understand. That's powerful.
I knew my mom and dad would be praying for me like crazy. It was hard on them because I was the only boy, and my dad was 50 when he got married. My mom was 35, so one generation was gone, so I knew that they were really worried. And yet another thing that's interesting, you know, being a good Baptist like I was, and a couple of guys back at the Baptist church were kind of different. This one, after I got wounded and went to the hospital for over 3 months, why I came back and joined an NPF. They put me in MP, put me in limited duty. They were stationed in Paris, of all places. So I went to Paris and went to the Folies Bergère, of all things. Press was outside, and it says, take. So they took me and a couple other guys and said, "We're going to take you in Folies Bergère." And so we went in there and took us backstage and put us on the lap of a couple of the gals and took pictures. And it's going to be the Life magazine, for Life magazine. And I thought, oh, man. What's the people of the church are going to say? But it never got published. I mean, never made the press. But
did you ever see the pictures?
No, I never saw the picture or anything, you know.
Well, maybe they're still out there somewhere. There is definitely more to Jake Jacobson's story, but it's time for our final break. You know, 4 decades after World War II, Jake and some of his fellow veterans returned to Benware, France, to honor those who did not come home and to see firsthand what their shared sacrifice had produced for the people there. But we still need to hear the rest of what happened there. We're going to take you back to December 30th, 1944, and catch the rest of that story behind his Purple Heart when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 95-year-old Jake Jacobson about a brief period of his life as a teenager that has affected every day since. A glance at his wall in Shaver Lake, California, reveals the insignia of the 3rd Infantry Division. You'll also see the Bronze Star, the Combat Infantry Badge, and yes, the Purple Heart, stemming from one cold, dark, painful night in France that we need to explore a little more. Jake, what all do you remember about December 30th, 1944?
We'd gone out the day before and gotten almost captured. And so that day away, he says, you guys are going out and attacking again. And that's when the sergeant says, I'm not going to go. He says, they're going to kill us off. You know, that's suicide. So all of us said, okay, we're not going to go. They came and says, I Company fall out. And we went out there to tell them they're not going to go. And they says, you guys got it made tonight. You got 4 tanks with you. And you guys, 10 from L, 10 from K, 10 from anti-tankers. So they formed a battle group. So we said, you know, we're going to have to go. So we started, and usually start is after midnight before we went on the attack, trying to help the Germans be asleep by the time we get up there. We took off, and you go behind the tanks because they can knock them out with bazookas or artillery. So you stay right behind them. You swing in behind them. If you go through a vineyard, why, you let them knock down the wire that holds the vines up, or you duck under. And that day they went, why, I followed behind, and then I moved behind the wire, and I thought, well, I'll just duck under. And I started hangling up in the with my helmet and gun and things. So I said, I'll swing in behind the tank. So I started swinging behind the tank, and they were laying mortar behind the tank. And the mortar shell went off, and it went through my hand. It cut the tendons in my hand and started bleeding badly. And another guy had just shot through the leg. Another guy had shrapnel his back. So once you're hit, you can leave without a bit of problem, you know. And so we started walking back to the aid station, and it took us probably a half hour to walk back. The tanks went on up and got knocked out one after another, and our lieutenant had rifle grenades stuck in his belt, and the shrapnel lighted one of those rifle grenades and burned him up. And he was a Congressional Medal winner. They gave him a Congressional honor for earlier time that he had spent. He's Lieutenant Candell. And so when we went over there, we visited where they'd buried him and stuff, and so he just won. But and then the guy, when we went back to Benware, there's another Medal of Honor winner went with us, so It was a fruitful time, you know. But anyway, after I got hit, well, I was one of the last Company I men to come back alive. And I got to the aid station, and the guy was bandaging up my hand, and he says, how's your head? I said, what do you mean, how's my head? And he says, were you wearing your helmet? And I says, yeah. And he said, well, look at it. And I took it off, and there's a 6-inch slit through the helmet and helmet liner, and it hadn't touched my head. So I knew then that, you know, God had spared me again. And he's done many times since then, so it's a plan and a purpose. So
I guess so. And I know you've shared this story before. I know you lived it, and it's been part of your memory for 76 years. But the way you describe it is so matter-of-factly, so no big deal. But you're a 19-year-old kid. That had to be painful when they hit your left hand and the shrapnel severs your tendon. So does that mean you didn't have the use of that hand at that point?
These two ears. These two. And they connect both of them at the hospital. This one worked and this one worked. They sent me to England and operated again, and it still didn't work. If you wait 6 months for a tendon and don't attach it, it goes on up your arm and they can't do it. So what they did, they took both of these tendons and connected on this, so this and this, both of them.
So your pinky finger and your ring finger on your left hand, at this point when you're hit, you can't move them at all.
No.
They're just dead weight on your hand, and it's bleeding quite a bit. Are you feeling the pain?
Pain wasn't that bad, but this guy that got hit through the leg, he took that, put under his arm, and squeezed it tight so it didn't bleed so much.
And you have no idea that you've been hit in the helmet?
No. It wasn't until he said, "How's your head?"
You didn't feel anything hit
no.
you?
No.
And as you're walking back to that aid station, what's going through your mind?
I get to leave. I can get to the hospital and have sheets and food again, you know. Because in your combat, you don't have hot food hardly ever. And you have K rations or C rations. But you survive.
But this is a moment that almost claimed your life. But it sounds like the most prevalent emotion you were experiencing was one of relief.
Right.
And that tells us how bad the combat life had been for you.
You really think you're not going to make it. You know, you think, but by the grace of God, you do. You know, it's praise the Lord, I didn't have to go back to combat, you know.
So you've lost the use of those two fingers. Later on, they're able to attach them to another tendon so that you can lift them in unison. They don't have their own separate tendons.
This is far to go by itself, and it lifts both of them.
So you had that going on. And then when the medic asks you, how's your head, and you see the hole it was right in the front of your helmet?
No, right along this side.
Right above your temple, there's a 6-inch hole in your helmet.
And liner.
So I've talked to a lot of guys where, you know, a bullet or some shrapnel penetrated the helmet, but not the liner. And it went back out a second hole in the helmet. But you're saying not only is your helmet not just creased, but penetrated, there's a hole in the liner too. But you've got no wound on your head.
No wound on my head.
How is that possible?
God's grace.
I mean, doesn't that defy logic?
Yeah.
Had you ever seen that happen with anybody else?
No.
So what was your reaction at the time when you saw that?
Thankful I talked to the Lord and said, I won't complain about anything again.
So what do you think happened as you try to explain in your own mind how you could have that situation with your helmet and your liner both penetrated but no wound? Do you think a piece of shrapnel passed through parallel and just was that close to your scalp and didn't break it?
Yep.
So, I mean, in that case, if that's what happened, had that been a quarter of an inch deeper?
It'd have been all over.
Am I exaggerating the margin there?
No.
So that's how close you came to being killed that night.
And I've had a number of cases. Probably 8 years or so ago, I had a heart valve, that aorta valve in your heart failed. Doctor says you need to have this operated on, you know, within the next 2 years or probably die. So anyway, I went in and I had a pig's valve put in my aorta valve. It worked perfectly for 8 years at least. A couple years ago, it started failing. And so I went back to the doctor and he sent me back to my surgeon and talked to him. And he says, the problem with you, he says, you're living a lot longer than the pig's supposed to live. And he said, it's failing and we'll keep you comfortable and see if you don't have any pain or anything. After I'd been there, I found out the next day I was supposed to go back to my heart doctor. And so I had the elders lay hands on me and pray for me that night. And I didn't notice anything that night. But by morning, I know something had happened. And so when I got to the doctor's house, I said, you guys might think I'm nuts. I says, but I think God healed me last night. And they says, well, you know, we'll see. So they put me through a stress test and EKG, and they came back after all this has been gone through. The doctor says, this shouldn't happen. They says, your heart is stronger than it was a year ago. Your valve is working better. They said, and that's been 2.5 years ago or so.
Well, let's go back to the last few days of 1944. So you're wounded, and you said you'd spend the next 3 months in the hospital, is that what you said?
Yes.
What was going on in your mind and your world for those 3 months?
Enjoying the sheets, the good food, the entertainment, you know, movies and stuff you go to. And entertainment in the surgical center was really something. They used TruSeer to put people to sleep for operations. And every day, a couple of guys would go into surgery and then come back, and they were drunk as a skunk. I mean, that stuff made them, and they were trying to make the nurses and stuff in the ward went in charge, and it was a real entertainment.
I imagine being in the hospital, too. I mean, there's a lot of time to think about things. Were you thinking about how close you came? Were you thinking about some of the guys that were not going to get to come home? What were some of the things that went through your mind?
First, you're real thankful that, you know, doesn't know where you're going to end up, but you got out, and the war wasn't quite over, you know, at that time, but it was pretty well down, and we joined this MP outfit, and being an MP wasn't all exciting after being combat infantry, but anyway, they were a bunch of older guys who'd been in the Army for 3 years or more, and kind of set in their ways, and us kids come in, the outfit was being filled up with 19-year-old combat. But we had the ribbons and the combat infantry badges and what have you. They were almost jealous of us. They had an attitude against us, and anyway, couldn't do anything for us, you know, and help us until this MP outfit found out it was scheduled to go to Japan. All of a sudden, on the ship going, it took us some 50-some days to go from Marseille, France, through the canals, and we got parallel with San Francisco. Suddenly they thought, oh, all these guys know combat, and we better be making friends with them. So they made real friends with us because they were getting scared because they thought they were going to Japan.
Well, how did you feel about that, going to Japan?
I didn't like it. You know, it was scary, but just seeing the attitude of these guys made it humorous, you know.
You come all the way around, you go through the Panama Canal, you're out here in the Pacific, as you said, parallel to San Francisco, and that's when you found out that Japan had surrendered too?
Yeah, they'd surrendered, and so, oh boy, you know, we're going to get to go to San Francisco and be the first ones in, you know, from combat. But they had a hospital unit that needed to go to Philippine Islands, so they shipped us all over to Philippine Islands and stayed there for 6 months before I had enough points to come home.
What'd you do over there?
We was in this company, and us guys that were staying on longer, they transferred a lot of them over, but out of combat, I had to be a company clerk. And so we had this company, and they got orders that deactivate this company, and they just put the rest of them over in this battalion, this big MP battalion over there. And so Lieutenant and I was in charge of deactivating the company, and he comes and says, do you want to move over there, or do you want to stay around until someone really gets angry that we're not there? And I says, let's stay around. And so he could get a Jeep to go out for recreation at night. So we stayed there for a month or two, stayed till the colonel found out about it. And he called us over and says, what in the heck are you doing? I'll give you till the night to transfer over here. So we got over there. But it was worth it to spend 2 months of enjoying life. Our job was, after I moved over, you know, was guarding mail trucks to keep them from confiscating mail and whatever. It was easy to do, you know.
And then coming back home to California, seeing your family again, what was that like?
It was pretty good. Came in San Francisco and going to get out of the service, and this thing had been operated on twice already, was still didn't work. I mean, it hung down. And
your pinky finger would just hang limp.
So when I went through for discharge, he was up in San Francisco, went through, and I says, I want to get my hand fixed up before I go home. They said, well, you're lucky, you know. I said, I know I'm lucky, but I got the rest of my life to live, and I want a hand that works, you know. So they took me in the hospital up there, and they took this thing and broke it all the way down and put a cast on it and left it. And when I got the cast off, you know, the finger didn't work at all. So I still wanted it fixed, so they said, okay, we'll go to Pasadena, the big hospital down in Pasadena. I was in there 6 months before I got out, and they did it, and they transferred it over onto the other tenant, and it worked. And so I got it fixed. But if I hadn't have yelled, I wouldn't have done it. But I figured it, you know, if they could get it fixed, let's get it fixed.
Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, what you shared, how you ended up in farming was you had that injury on your left hand, and then you cut off the tips of your index finger and your middle finger on your right hand. But you also said that when you were in that foxhole in France before you got wounded, you promised God you wouldn't complain about anything else the rest of your life.
I lied there. I guess he must not have cared.
Well, I was going to give you credit for not complaining despite those real difficult circumstances there. And obviously, it's not something that you've dwelled on, if I see all the stuff you've done since and how active you are. But I was just curious about the source of your optimism or perspective to not let those things weigh you down.
I figure I'm here because of the grace of God plus him taking care of me, and I'm very thankful.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story that only you could tell us. I'm curious, when you think back over 95 years, when it comes to the time you spent in the Army, and this is when you were physically, in theory, at your best, right? You're young, you're full of life, you're strong, and you gave those years to your country and to the people you liberated in Europe. What do you think is important for the rest of us to know about what happened then? Because so many of us didn't live through that. How do you think we should view that time in our history and understand the things that you and all those other guys you were with did?
I believe that, you know, that was an important time in my life, that I'm made to become who I am. I've always known the Lord, even as a young kid. My mom probably took me to church when I was, you know, 3 weeks old or something. And the importance of then and the importance of now, I found that God is more important than that. But yet that's what made who I am. And I'm so thankful that I've been able to live my life as to him, and I know where I'm going. And if I die tomorrow, I'm going up there. I don't have to worry.
Is there something that after 95 years, as you look back, you'd say that you are most proud of?
Just that I found out, you know, there's more than conventional churches. There's the Spirit of the living God that wants to live within men and women, and he's still available, and he still wants to. Don't neglect that. That's the most important part of your lives.
And is there something at age 95 that you haven't done yet, that you haven't experienced yet, that you're still kind of looking forward to?
I'm looking for the time I go up there. That's something to look forward to and want and expect, and it's so important, so important. If I can leave that with people.
One other question I have, not to be melodramatic or morose or anything, just to get your real view on it, because you talked about how decimated your unit was, how many guys were lost. We heard how close you came to not coming home. Those men who died, how should we remember them all these years later?
What they did for us, you know, it's part of who we were, the country. I think they did to keep Germany from taking over the world, and we would have been entirely different people. Sure, it's tough, but you're thinking more of your friends that you spend, because we were in England with so many of them, and there's one thing that's important is when you have tough things to do, you have to decide with your own mind what you're going to do through it. And when you go to combat, you're saying, okay, I'm going combat. If they're shooting at me, I'm going to shoot at them. And don't have to start rethinking it when the situation becomes tough. You've already figured out what you're going to do and then do it. And you need to set that no matter what things you do. Decide. Decide the tough thing.
Maybe that little exhortation is relevant in your life today. I know it is in mine. Jake Jacobson, 95 years old. You'll find a short video with Jake and some photos related to the stories he shared today at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And the next time it snows in Shaver Lake, California, you'll find Jake out there plowing his driveway. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.